This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. We are preparing on the Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable, for a State of the State address today. Yes, it was supposed to happen at noon, kicking off the year's legislative session. But as is the trend, another snowstorm has swept through, and now it seems as though we won't have a State of the State starting until noon. As a matter of fact, as we'll talk about in a bit, Governor Daniel Malloy has asked non-essential state workers to just stay home today, asked a lot of private employers to have their workers do the same. So, yes, it's another big snowstorm. We're going to talk about politics, and we're going to talk about news, some legislative priorities this year, but we also want to hear from you. Call us at 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. We want to hear your winter storm reports. How much snow did you get where you live? Have the plows actually come down your street? They just came down my street not that terribly long ago. So let us know if you're heading to work or not today. 860-275-7266. We've got a big pot of coffee on, and we're happy to be joined, as always, by Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. How was your commute in, Colin?
My commute was very easy. I judge trouble by Nancy Wyman's game face. So when she's standing next to Governor Malloy, I don't listen to what he's talking about. I just look at her, and I know, you know, how dangerous things are getting.
I didn't get a chance to see it on television. How did she look? Did she seem confident?
That we sum up her mood as, these are the end times, but we have it under control.
That's okay. So Colin's here. Mark Pazniokas, Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. You even made it in today, Paz. My goodness, thank you very much for coming in.
This is part of my daily affirmation that, yes, I am essential.
Yes, you are essential. It's nice to hear that. Well, let's talk briefly about this. Has this ever happened in your memory that we've postponed the start of a legislative session because of snow?
No, although I will confess that thanks to the governor's minimum wage pitch yesterday, I didn't have any time to stop by my friends at the legislative library and inquire if they have any record of it happening before. But no, certainly not. I've been a journalist in Connecticut since 1979. And no, I don't recall it ever happening.
One thing I would say is that if you were going to try to imagine what a non-essential state employee would be, you would start with a legislator.
Well, actually, in his press briefing, which we carried at 8 o'clock this morning live on WNPR, Governor Malloy did talk a little bit about that. He made a little joke, a semi-joke, about non-essential state employees. The fact of the matter is, it is a word that's a little bit loaded, but he was essentially saying that they know who they are and they should stay home. The people who know they should come to work should come to work, but he also talked about private employers as well.
I'd like to ask private employers to follow the state's lead, at least with respect to employees that you absolutely don't need to come to work. It is messy out there. There's a very heavy snow. It's packed in places, and local roads are in terrible shape.
I will say local roads are in terrible shape, including not that far from our offices right here. I was tweeting all morning long from my town of Winsted. They actually didn't get around to plowing my street until around 7:30. We have about a foot of snow on the street right now, and it would have been impossible to get here. But the plows are indeed out. Snow pushed back the State of the State address in Massachusetts last month. As a matter of fact, Governor Deval Patrick gave his speech less than 2 hours before President Obama gave the State of the Union address. There has been a lot of news coming out of other states, neighboring Connecticut. New York has actually shut down a part of I-84 through the state. And there's a state of emergency in New Jersey, although whenever we see these tweets from Governor Chris Christie about traffic slowdowns, we always pause for a moment beforehand. Let's quickly go to a few of our other guests here and get them on the line. Christine Stewart from CT News Junkie is joining us by phone today. Christine, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So how is snow this morning for you? Bad times getting around?
You know, I'm in Windsor, and it's a little difficult. We had to shovel a path for the dog to get out.
Oh, you had to shovel a path for the dog to get out. The dog is an essential state employee?
Yeah, the dog, it is essential that the dog get out of the house.
That's probably probably a very good idea. And I also want to bring in Tom Condon, who is Hartford Courant's deputy editorial page editor. He joins us by phone today. Hey, Tom.
Hey, John.
Hey, so you have any recollection of this? Paz didn't get a chance to go to the state library and figure it out. Have we ever had a legislative session that you know of delayed by snow?
Absolutely not, in my memory. But as Mark Twain might say, your life and property are safe for one more day.
So for one more day. I want to get to a quick phone call, and we are asking you if you want to join us to talk a bit about the snow. 860-275-7266. James is on the line from New Haven. Hey, James, what's it like there? James, are you there? Oh, no.
I think we have our answer.
Now I feel bad. James is gone, hopefully not stuck in a snowstorm. Well, let's get to something, John. Yeah, please.
I just want to say that we did get a chance to call the Legislative Library, and it was 1978, the last time the State of the State was canceled.
Oh, okay, wow.
So 1978, the blizzard of 1978, and it was moved from a Wednesday to a Friday.
Moved from a Wednesday to a Friday, 1978. I guess I didn't remember the dates of the blizzard of 78. I didn't realize that it had come over the start of the session.
You note that I was able to bring us back to 79, and Christine jumped right in with 1978.
I was one year old.
Thank you, Christine.
Yes, I was going to say,
welcome.
And thank you very much, Christine Stewart. We won't be needing you for the rest of the show. If you would have joined us at 860-275-7266, you can tell us about the snow. But let's get to some of the news, including the news you talked about from yesterday, Paz. Governor Dana Malloy proposed raising the minimum wage to $10.10. That's the same rate that the federal government has been talking about raising it to, at least backed by President Obama. Let's listen to a little bit of what he had to say.
We are aggressively moving to $9. We will do that with the first installment this January 1st, followed by another installment. I think that there is a reality that the minimum wage has not kept pace with inflation since minimum wages were established. And we should certainly look at moving in an appropriate direction, which is increasing the minimum wage. On the other hand, I'm not sure how far out in front of every other state we have to get. With this increase on January 1st, we'll be, I think, in the top five or six states. I know Vermont is also seeing a 15% increase, if I remember correctly. Some other states are seeing an increase. Vermont probably will continue to be the leader in this area. I'm very proud of what we're doing, and that is to get to $9.
So my apologies. And that was actually Governor Malloy from where we live not too terribly long ago. He was on the program, Paz, and I asked him about this. I said, the federal government is going to $10.10. What about Connecticut? He said, we're aggressively moving to $9. We're going there. We don't want to get too far out ahead of anyone else. Now, about a month or so later, he's getting out ahead. What happened?
That's a better clip that you played than something you could have got from yesterday, because it does illustrate the change. I mean, Governor Malloy has been fairly cautious about the minimum wage, not wanting to get out too far in front of the other states. He has embraced what is, I believe, going to be a great campaign issue. Democrats across the country are going to run on this. It's a great topic. You know, if you don't want to talk about the Affordable Care Act, minimum wage increase, every poll shows, is a great issue. The governor obviously was familiar with the polls. He quoted a poll to us yesterday. I believe he shared the fact that even Republicans are at 57% or 58%.
Sometimes he shies away from this whole talking about the polls thing. I mean, he doesn't necessarily like to say, well, of course, the polls show this is what everyone wants, and that's why I'm going to do it. He doesn't usually do that, Pat.
He does not usually do that. He says he doesn't like to talk about them, but that doesn't mean that he doesn't read them. And, you know, one of the more interesting things about yesterday was when I got hold of Tom Foley on the phone, and, you know, I had already spoken to Mark Boughton, and he poo-pooed it. Tom Foley said, well, yeah, I think 10-10's a reasonable minimum wage. And, you know, I think there should be some exceptions. You know, he's talking about, you know, the old Republican idea of a tiered minimum wage. You know, you might have a training wage or an entry level wage. But in general, Tom Foley, who wants to be the Republican nominee for governor, basically agreed with Governor Malloy that 10-10 is a reasonable place to get to.
Colin, should we be at all surprised by this? Obviously, given what the governor said to me not that long ago, I was slightly surprised about this announcement yesterday. What do you think?
Well, I mean, if this were the Daily Show, I think we'd have to develop some kind of audio graphic that called How You Know This Is an Election Year. And I mean, there's so many ways in which, I mean, even today, you know, it wasn't part of the clip that we just played, but Governor Malloy, actually, when he was talking about keeping state workers home, he said, non-essential. Oh, I hate that word. And I'm thinking, this man in whose mouth butter would not melt suddenly is very concerned with calling anybody non-essential. So this is how you know it's an election year. And I think this is very poll-driven. And Foley's response to Paz, I noted too, suggesting also that they don't want to be on the wrong side of this. I mean, maybe McKinney and Boutner are willing to be on the wrong side of this. This obviously is a pretty well poll-tested, poll-driven, probably focus-grouped idea, and people understand that it actually will fly.
Well, what we've already heard, Christine, though, is, of course, and this is not surprising, but business groups have said this is going to cost jobs, this is going to be a problem. This is what was essentially argued for years before this lower minimum wage was already passed at the state level. Do you expect much more pushback from business groups who Governor Malloy, honestly, has also been trying to court over the course of the last several years?
Oh, yeah. Business groups do not appreciate this. But the thing is, it's very difficult, even when you attend these press conferences held by the Working Families Party, you know, a group that has cross-endorsed Malloy and who supports an increase in the minimum wage. It's very difficult to find somebody who is actually making minimum wage. I think I have yet to be able to speak to somebody. So there are these arguments, and it's based on how well you think the economy is doing at the time. But I don't think that there are very many people who make the minimum wage.
I think one,
the governor says there are somewhere between 70,000, 80,000, yeah. I think. And there's an institute that studied this that said if you project ahead to 2016, which was Obama's goal for 10-10, that in Connecticut it would be there'd be over 100,000 people.
But you think about it in terms of upward pressure, too, that, yeah. that if you bump the bottom up, the rest of the thing goes up, too. And I mean, you know, going back to Obama's speech, I as he was talking about that, and he showed the pizza guy who, you know, pays more than the minimum wage. And I was thinking, you know, Henry Ford used to say that his workers should make enough money so that they could buy a Ford. And now it's maybe a pizza, you know.
Maybe. I think with a coupon, you can get
maybe
two for
you can
one.
Buy one of the pizzas you make.
Well, there's a difference between a minimum wage and a living wage. So, I mean, what the governor is talking about is a minimum wage. It is not a living wage.
And there's another proposal out there that, I mean, this may take the steam out of it. You know, there's what's called the Walmart bill, which is the idea of trying to set a goal of a living wage, and big companies, not just big retailers, that don't hit that would be forced to either pay into a state fund or raise a wage. And the idea is that a lot of employees in places like that are getting state services. Their employees are getting Medicaid. They may be eligible for food stamps and so forth.
Well, is there a way to make this, to roll this out in a way so that those big retailers, those national retailers, and we know the ones that we're talking about here that pay very low wages and whose employees are taking some money in services from the state, that we really would be able to target them in a certain way and not have this impact the smaller employers, the mom and pops that
absolutely.
I think are going to be.
You can you know you can set by size and there's language out there that would clearly focus. Well, there's a reason it's called the Walmart bill. Let's just leave it at that.
We're talking today with Mark Pazniokas from the Connecticut Mirror. Also on the line with us is Christine Stewart, editor of CTNewsJunkie.com. Tom Condon is here. He's the deputy editorial page editor of the Hartford Courant. It's a snow day here on Where We Live. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to tackle another issue that has sort of come back to the fore. This is education reform. Governor Malloy had one idea about education reform and teacher evaluations a little while ago. It is an election year, and things have changed a little bit. We had a conversation with Stephen Pryor yesterday. We'll hear a bit from that and get some thoughts from our panel. We'll also hear from you at 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. It's Wednesday, so it's the Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. We're in the Wheelhouse with Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. The show at 1 o'clock today. What's on the show today, Colin?
Before I tell you that, I just want to say our new motto here that is here at WNPR, our staff is tougher than Christine Stewart's dog. You know, we got like Lydia Brown came 2.5 hours with her father. Anna Novak, one of our interns,
in
the parking lot. People aren't like, we don't have to shovel so they can pee. You know?
Tucker Ives was in here hosting Morning Edition. A heroic job out of Tucker Ives. We know who is essential and non-essential right here at WNPR.
Anyway,
clearly,
our show today is about 50 years ago, the Beatles appeared on Ed Sullivan. A thrill for people of a certain age. Dickie Robinson, who was actually one of the DJs of that era, who played the Beatles. I think they might have even cut a promo for him or something. Anyway, he'll be on with us briefly. Plus, a bunch of musicologists and musicians just talking about how the world changed for them when they were standing there in their footy pajamas with their toy guitars, suddenly watching these guys light it up.
As we heard earlier, Christine Stewart from CT News Junkie is with us. She was not old enough to remember the Beatles playing Ed Sullivan. Tom Condon, what do you remember about the Beatles quickly?
Oh, unbelievable. Took the country by storm. An amazing story. They were sort of a house band in Liverpool, and two years later, they're an international cultural sensation. It's an astounding story.
Tom Condon is Hartford Current's deputy editorial page editor. We're going to be talking with him about some of the priorities for the legislative session that they rolled out in the newspaper the other day. One of the things has to do with education. And so we've talked a bit about the minimum wage, about how Governor Malloy just yesterday announced that he wants to increase the state's minimum wage to $10.10 an hour. Something else that has happened recently is because of an awful lot of pressure coming from educators around the state, the Malloy administration has decided to slow down some of the teacher evaluations that are part of the Common Core state standards, big changes in education that were coming down the pike. We got a chance to talk with Stephen Pryor, the Commissioner of Education, yesterday about this.
I'm proud of the fact that although perhaps it was a bit too fast, perhaps that we should have actually taken into account some of these other points of feedback, we're not just sticking with it for the sake of being tough and proceeding. Instead, the message from the governor is we need to continue to adjust and listen to teachers.
So that adjustment and listening to teachers, one of the tweets that I got during the show yesterday, Colin, was, well, this is happening in an election year. It's quite obvious it's happening in an election year. Is this a big surprise given all the pressure that's coming from educators?
Well, I'll be interested to hear what the rest of the people on the show here have to say about this, and particularly Tom, because, I question how well this stuff plays, actually. And, I mean, clearly the teachers are in a state of revolt now about this. And I'm not sure that the public isn't, to a certain degree, following them along a little bit, too. I was struck by one of Mark's colleagues writing about this and describing the teacher of the year from last year, trying to fill out one of these complicated evaluation forms or get it started, and then Obamacare style, the thing crashed and he lost all his work. And I think a lot of people are thinking, really, you want the teacher of the year filling out this thing and having it crash, and this is a good thing for him to be doing? But the reason I mentioned Tom is, the Current a couple of weeks ago ran a piece in his section by Liz Natale, who's a teacher in Glastonbury, about how all of this stuff, all of this sort of ratcheting up of testing and accountability and Common Core standards, and that is wrecking the teaching profession. Not an original sentiment, not the first time you've heard it, but for some reason or other, this really kicked a tripwire, and this thing stayed on the Current site as one of the most read things for, I think, maybe not just days, but weeks. And it wasn't just teachers, I don't think, who were keeping it there. I think people are starting to wonder what we're doing with our educators and whether or not this really is the best thing for the kids they teach. But Tom, maybe you could say something about that, too. Like, why did that stay up there so long? Did you ever get a clue about that?
Well, it went viral nationally. I mean, it struck a chord across the country, across the world. I mean, the hits on it were astonishing. I mean, it was the number one in hits for weeks. It's incredible, a phenomenon. I think she touched a nerve. There's a lot of frustration out there, and pulling back on using test scores as part of the evaluation was only that was only humane, for crying out loud. A lot of the kids haven't had the material that is going to be on the standardized test yet. They're in a transition period. So, you can't test people on material they haven't had yet. So it's a volatile time over there.
Well, Tom, in your editorial at the Hartford Current, talking about some of the priorities for this short legislative session, education is among the headlines. I mean, what do you see as the legislature's role in education reform this time around? Because, again, they have passed laws that are moving us closer toward this idea of a Common Core, closer toward an idea of teacher evaluations of the type that are now being rolled back. And now it seems as though things are being rolled back. What do you see as the role of the legislature moving forward in education reform this time around?
I don't know that there is one this year. I mean, they're in this transition period. They're trying to install a slightly higher set of standards. And the Common Core is not a curriculum. It's a set of standards, things you ought to know in each grade as they move along. And so it is more an administrative rather than a legislative function right now. I think, that said, obviously the legislature is going to be watching this very, very closely. Yesterday, Senator McKinney called for Commissioner Pryor to resign. So it's obviously a volatile issue. The key here, I think, is administrative. It's sort of a parallel to Obamacare. You've got to implement it correctly. I think the standards, I've gone through the standards. They appear to be basically strong. They fit the existing one, although the existing ones are very hard to read too. But they appear to track the existing ones more than not and improve them in some cases, with a couple of glaring exceptions. But so I think administratively right now the key is in the implementation, just as in Obamacare.
Now, Tom mentioned some of the politics out of this. Here is Senator John McKinney, who is, of course, running as a Republican for governor, talking about Stephen Pryor and education reform in the state.
We can't go forward if teachers and administrators don't have faith and trust in the people who are charged with implementing those reforms. And that's why I'm calling today, although something I consider difficult to do, calling today for the resignation of Commissioner Stephen Pryor.
Okay, Christine Stewart from CT News Junkie. What does that say to you that John McKinney is jumping right on this as a Republican?
He's jumping right on this, but I don't think that it is a partisan issue. I think when we're talking about the rollout of these Common Core standards, it brings together the left and the right equally. You have Republicans and people who are progressive, like blogger Jonathan Peltow, in agreement on these Common Core standards, and that, somebody needs to hit the pause button here.
Mark Pazniokas?
It's not a partisan issue as far as dissatisfaction, but it is a partisan issue when a Republican candidate for governor tries to embarrass the Democratic governor, and that's what part of yesterday was about. McKinney knows this is a good issue with teachers. The governor has a lot of problems with unionized teachers right now, starting with that ill-considered line in his speech a couple of years ago that all you have to do to get tenure is to show up. That's put him on a bad path with teachers. And then the botched rollout of the Common Core, of having teachers sit at these computers systems that aren't working, is just infuriating them. So Christine's right. There's a lot of dissatisfaction with it. But I would say that what McKinney did yesterday had a definite partisan aspect to it.
It had a part of – go ahead, Christine.
I was just going to say that I agree. He's alienated a constituency group and people who support the Second Amendment. So he needs to find another constituency to support his candidacy.
But the thing that's very interesting about this is, of course, John McKinney is going to be running here against other Republicans for the Republican nomination. This does not necessarily, the issue of education reform does not necessarily cut along partisan lines. But indeed, many people in the pro-business community have been very pro-reform of the type that is coming down from the Common Core. School choice, the idea of charter schools, the idea of making teachers who are heavily unionized change the way they do things. This is something that Republicans and conservative Democrats have really made a much bigger issue than anybody else. I mean, it's just an interesting place for John McKinney to be, I suppose.
It is. And, the same is true of Tom Foley. Foley, when he announced the other day, officially announced, he reached out to teachers in a big way. And, typically Republicans have been very supportive of charter schools, have been very supportive of things that moved schools away from unionized workplaces, quite frankly. And Foley was very careful the other day to go nowhere near that. He said that, charter schools are interesting, but it's going to be a small piece of what we do.
I think also this thing goes in phases. So what John McKinney's been doing a lot, really, is kind of hijacking traditionally Democratic positions, which isn't a great strategy, you would think, during the primary season. On the other hand, really, he's in the fundraising period right now, and he's way ahead of everybody else in getting to the goal for public financing. And so as Mr. Dankosky's pointing out, some of these dog whistles he's blowing may resonate a little bit. I mean, they resonate great with teachers, but I don't think he's going to raise a lot of money from them. But they may resonate pretty well with business, too. I'm not sure. He seems, anyway, to be talking to a different group of people right now. All he's got to really do is get to public financing, get through the convention, and then maybe get into the primary season. And I would expect to see him drift a little bit to the right after that. But maybe right now he's speaking to a more complicated core of potential money donors. Although, come to think of it, I don't know why business would be thrilled at exactly the way he staked this thing out on teachers.
If you want to join us, 860-275-7266, as we talk about some of the news of the week with our panel here on The Wheelhouse. It's our weekly news roundtable. In studio, Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show, Mark Pazniokas from the Connecticut Mirror. On the phone with us, Christine Stewart from CTNewsJunkie.com and Tom Condon from the Hartford Current's editorial page. Tom, getting to some of the other legislative priorities that you folks laid out in the current, things that you think might get done. You talk about the state budget. What do you hope gets done with the state budget this year? Because, you know, now we've got this big surplus, right? We're going to spend all this new money.
John, before we leave the Common Core, one last thought. It was adopted in Connecticut in 2010. Why are we arguing about it now? And I think the answer is because it's a political year. And the implementation is trouble. But this has been out here for almost 4 years. Now, moving on to the budget, what we hope is that all of it gets put back into either the rainy day fund or paying down debt. The idea of sending everybody a check is is a transparently political stunt, and just shouldn't do it. I believe Colin's friend Governor Rowland did it in 1998. And it doesn't have any impact on the economy, and what it's a dinner, I guess. But so we'd rather see all the money used to pay down debt or put in the rainy day fund.
Is it? And we talked about this a little bit in the newsroom yesterday. Economy, is it? If indeed we get a check back of something, you know, $50, $100 from the governor, is remembering that Governor Rowland did the same thing and we all got a $100 check and we went out and did whatever we did with that. Do you think that ends up being a good move, a bad move for Daniel Malloy?
Well, first of all, as I think Paz pointed out earlier this week, at least he figured out how to do it so that we wouldn't get this huge tax bite taken out of it. In the case of Governor Rowland, he gave, I think, $50 back to single people, $100 to couples, and $1,000 to people who would do something really nice for him. So, but he didn't set it up so that it was tax-free, which is kind of a problem. So anyway, I know this is nonsense. It's complete nonsense, and I don't think it really fools anybody. And I mean, obviously, there are people for whom $55 is a tank of gas, and they could use a tank of gas, but I don't think it gets them, you know, to the ballot box in any other frame of mind. It's ridiculous, and I'm sure the administrative costs of doing it are relatively high, too. I mean, it just... I don't know why they do it.
I want to get to a quick phone call here. Charles is calling from Plainville. Hey, Charles, go ahead. How's the snow look for you?
Well, I just got in. It's pretty hairy out there. But I got to hand it to Norwich. They did a good job of cleaning their streets. I mean, their streets are clearer than 395. And so I give kudos to that.
Well, that's good. What's on your mind?
Okay, two things. We're talking about the storms here with ice. Why don't we put these power lines on the ground? I mean, the money we've spent the last 4 years, I mean, the lost food and everything would be more cost effective. And secondly, I'd like the governor to put some pressure on the two casinos, one of which I work for, who will personally, in the next 2 weeks, be firing 9 people that I know because they're pointed out for attendance. Now, the tribes say, we never fire anybody for not coming in because it's not safe. No, that's not what they say. They say, we're firing you because you non-attendance. And this falls usually on people that are 50 or older that have health issues and they've used up their sick time. You can't call in and use vacation time.
What you're talking about is people unable to make it into work because of the snow, because of bad weather.
Yeah, the governor says stay home. The only time that tribes ever back down from this is Governor Rejo declared a state of emergency, and whoever was her spokesman said yes, and that means the two casinos.
Well, first of all, Charles, thank you very much for your phone call. I'm glad you're able to make it in safe. I know, Paz, we've talked a little bit about where the Republican convention is going to be this year. It's actually going to be at the Mohegan Sun Casino, which is a maxed out donor for the Democratic Party.
It is.
It's sort of interesting little thing. So Charles is asking, can the governor hold any sway with the casinos when it comes to this, do you think? Has a big smile on
Paz's
face.
Only in the big storm. Yeah. But and I would say to Charles, I don't think he would be happy with his electric bill if they buried every electric line in the state. Maybe Christine remembers the number, but there was a huge number that the two-storm panel came up with if you were going to do that. I think like Justin Greenwich, I think, was used as an example. I think Justin Greenwich would be like $1 billion. So
yeah,
and the ratepayers would pay.
Do you remember, Christine, because there was a multi-billion dollar number when we were talking about that through the whole CLMP fiasco?
Yeah, I don't remember the exact number, but it was up there. It was very costly, and I think Norwich is one of the towns that has its own electrical.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah,
that's correct.
Yeah, well, Norwich has its own. One thing that we have seen happen is a couple of the last storms we've had have not been the big heavy ice storms. They've been snowstorms that doesn't tend to knock down power lines. But as we've reported on WMPR, very aggressive tree cutting has indeed changed things a little bit in the state. A lot more trees are down. Governor Malloy declared that war on trees a couple years ago, and it seems as though that's kept a lot of power lines.
Only non-essential trees, however.
Non-essential trees.
And I will claim, you know, I don't think I was alone, but during that first extended blackout, I did foresee a cycle in which the complaining would go from the long blackouts to how their trees were being hacked because you knew it was coming.
I want to move on to something else. We talked about the state budget a little bit earlier. One of the ways in which the Malloy administration has tried to fill the state budget holes with this concept, this idea of Keno, another gambling game. We're not exactly sure how Keno would ever be rolled out, but it seems as though John McKinney, who we've been talking about, a Republican minority leader who's running for governor, said he plans to introduce legislation to repeal Keno. Christine, what do we know about this?
You know, look, right now the revenues are doing so well for the state, we actually don't need Keno. It was a last-minute thing that they put into the budget in order to balance the budget at that time. So, you know, there are some lawmakers who are going to call for a repeal of it. You know, the Connecticut Lottery Corporation is moving forward, and the state has been negotiating with the two tribal casinos to come up with some sort of agreement for revenue sharing. So it seems to be moving forward slowly, but whether it will actually get repealed, it's a possibility.
At the last meeting of the lottery board, they actually delayed action, although the reason was because the state and the tribes had not negotiated their deal. I mean, there's that little legal issue to be resolved. But Christine's right. I mean, the attitude at the lottery seemed to be it's full speed ahead other than that. But it's not, you know, it's not a big revenue number, and it is unpopular. So I think a lot of legislators would hope this thing would just go away.
It's not a big revenue number. And Colin, as we've talked about, it's also a revenue number that seems to be just kind of like a number, not necessarily anything grounded in any discernible fact that we can tell.
You know, I had a very awkward conversation on the air with somebody from OPM about that, and It's a made-up number. And, I mean, I actually do think that, back to McKinney for a second, the Democrats have done enough repugnant things in the legislature over the last year or two as to leave room for a candidate like McKinney to run on some of these issues. I mean, he's also going to run on more open, cleaner government. If he can run against Keno, that's a good political position for him. And they left that kind of stuff on the table for somebody to exploit.
And the lottery insists, and I find this so hard to believe, but the lottery insists they have done no market research, that they can't tell you, will this create new gamblers or will this cannibalize their existing customers?
I bet Scientific Games has done some market research.
I bet they have.
you just talked about open and transparent government. I want to get to one more thing with Tom Condon before I have to let you go. In your editorial, Priorities for the Legislature Short Session, Tom, you talk about a tax on FOI. This is something, obviously, Colin and I have spent an awful lot of time talking about here. What do you think that the legislature should do about freedom of information this time around?
Here's what they should do. They should repeal the law they passed last year at the last minute with no public input. You know, it's sort of a textbook example of why we need open government. The law that, you know, that banned access to photographs and images of homicides. There was no need to do it. It was apparently based on a rumor that Michael Moore was going to release photographs from the Newtown killings, which turned out to be not true. In fact, somebody who looked at Michael Moore's blog could have actually figured that out. And so they passed this dead of night law, and then they created a task force, which was stacked in favor of more privacy, which has come out, not surprisingly, in favor of more privacy. What they should do is repeal it. The Freedom of Information Act in Connecticut, in existence since the mid-1970s, has been a fine law. There was no need to fool with it.
Mark Pasniokas, I mean, does the legislature take this up at all?
The Senate leadership, I am told, is trying to keep this from coming to a vote. But the question is going to be, will there be pressure from their members to bring it forward? It's, you know, it's always a popular thing to make a gesture regarding Newtown. But it's going to be a hard thing. If it's defeated, it will be through procedural means, you know, that it will never come to a vote. It's a short session. It's sometimes, you know, it's easier to play defense on things to keep things from coming to a vote. That may be how it goes down, if it goes down.
Christine Stewart, do you see anybody in the legislature at all who's making a big issue of this? Obviously, when this law was passed at the time, an awful lot of people were thinking just about Newtown. Are you seeing anybody at the state capitol right now who is saying, we have indeed rolled things back too far, we really need to make a change again?
You know, I don't know if they've rolled it back too far, or if they're going to come forward with any sort of proposals. I really do think that they're going to try to ignore the issue and make sure that it doesn't come up this year.
Christine Stewart is the editor of ctnewsjunkie.com. Good luck getting the dog out of the house today, Christine.
Thank you.
Tom Condon is Hartford Courant's deputy editorial page editor. Stay safe, Tom. Thanks so much.
Okay, John. Thank you.
Now, when we come back, we're going to be talking about another one of the big issues this week, changes to the Metro North Line. Governor Malloy has been talking a lot about that. We're also going to get an update from our own Harriet Jones about Lawrence and Memorial Hospital and an agreement after ongoing labor disputes. You can join us at 860-275-7266 as we talk about the news of the week here on The Wheelhouse on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, the death of Philip Seymour Hoffman has brought a lot of attention to the issue of heroin. It's a problem that's been prevalent in our state, one we've covered on our program in the past. We're going to revisit heroin and take a closer look at the science of addiction, discuss some of the supports that are available to addicts. You can join our conversation on tomorrow's Where We Live. Today, it's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. In the wheelhouse with us today is Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, who took a dog sled here, I suppose. Mark Pasniokas, Capital Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror, who trundled in from West Hartford, and you've been already out and about. Did you go to the governor's press briefing this morning?
I did not.
You did not get there?
I cleared my driveway, and I did see it on TV. It was stirring.
It was stirring. What the governor said, just in case you have not heard, non-essential state employees stay home today, essentially, at least first shift employees. He's also asked private employers to do the same. The snow's falling at the rate of a couple inches an hour, changing over to sleet in an awful lot of the state. You can give us your weather update right now if you want to call us at 860-275-7266. Now, even without the snow, the commute on Metro North has been questionable throughout this last year, to say the least. Governor Malloy announced over the weekend that the Department of Transportation would be upgrading parts of the New Haven Metro North line. Joining us by phone now is Martin Cassidy, who reports on transportation issues for the Advocate in Stamford. Martin, welcome to Where We Live. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks. Good morning.
So what exactly are these upgrades, and when will they be made?
Well, Governor Malloy, he announced on Sunday that they were starting a project similar to the work that was going on in Mount Vernon in September that caused the outage, the railroads, and they're going to upgrade the transformers in Cost-Cobb. Just going to increase the power supply of the railroad, and it's going to mean they can run longer trains. And this has like been a long-held goal for the railroad. The first part is supposed to be done in a little more than 2 weeks, I think, and then the second half in March. And it's being done on a much more accelerated schedule than the project in Mount Vernon had been progressing.
Where
the accident there, which crippled the railroad.
Where exactly is the money for this new speedy transformation here coming, Martin? I mean, if part of the problem in the past was money to pay for upgrades like this, where are we getting the money now?
I guess he's going to appropriate the money. I believe he's going to appropriate the money in the next bond commission meeting. I think it might be reallocated from somewhere else in the DOT's budget, actually, or the bond commission. I'm sorry, I'm not totally clear on where the extra money is coming from. They did bond, I think, $5 million of it in 2010, if I'm not mistaken.
Can you tell anything, about where the money's coming from, or if we need to have the money to do this?
The bond commission, $10 million is known as rounding error. Mm-hmm.
So let's go to Michael, who's calling from a cell phone here. Michael, go ahead. You're on Where We Live. Michael, are you there?
Yes. Hi. Good morning. I'm Michael Doyle. I'm the general chairman for the Association of Commuter Rail Employees.
Very good to hear from you. Thanks for calling in. What's on your mind?
Well, you know, I know we've had a lot of issues here in the last year. We've built the best commuter railroad in the country at Metro North, and over the last year, we've had a couple of major incidents, which we're all the employees are very concerned about. We are working with the management of the railroad. We have a new president coming on board. We're working with Commissioner Redeker, and I met on Sunday morning with Governor Malloy to assure him that the employees are going to do everything we can to try to get the railroad back to a state that we all expect it to operate at, the commuters, the employees, the management, and certainly the legislative leaders.
Michael, since we probably have some legislative leaders listening right now, I mean, what do you think the state needs to do? What needs to change a little bit to make sure that we have the safest, best, most reliable rail line?
Well, I think we need a five-year capital funding plan. In New York, they have a five-year plan. We're tied to the largest generator of commuter and mass transit in the world, probably the MTA. The MTA is a multi-billion-dollar operation. A lot of times, the MTA will subsidize some of the improvements we need, the joint improvements between New York and Connecticut under their capital funding, and then Connecticut will pass annual funding budgets and try to catch up with some of these projects. But I think if we had a five-year capital plan to plan out some of the infrastructure improvements that we need, I think that would go a long way.
Paz, do we see on the horizon this sort of idea of a big funding mechanism in place? Not the $10 million rounding error that we're talking about to fix a few things as far as power upgrades, but really talking about a state investment in Metro North. What do you see?
I don't know. I mean, Commissioner Redeker at the hearing after the power outage in Mount Vernon, his stance is that Connecticut was committing the funds to in a way that New York was not. And I will confess, I don't cover this enough to go much deeper than that. Your caller could probably offer far more information than there. The idea of a long, you know, a long-term funding plan is something that I think could get a good hearing this time, because the money, you know, you're coming up with a plan. It's not that you're appropriating the money each year, so it's not like it has the immediate budget impact. Legislators, you know, love to do these long-term things to at least set the goal. But I don't know if that's in the cards right now.
Michael, first of all, thank you very much for your phone call. I appreciate it, and best of luck.
Thank you so much.
I want to quickly get back to Martin Cassidy from The Advocate in Stamford. You wrote about signal malfunctions in the Danbury branch of Metro North. Is this something we should be worried about at all?
It seems like the railroad is taking a very cautious approach to deal with it. But, yes, I mean, it is a brand-new system that was just completed in November. And the federal government put a lot of, I think, $42 million into it. They're following up, and the railroad has represented that they did do the proper inspections on it, but it is somewhat a hazardous situation, because the drivers coming upon the grade crossings, they will, you know, there's a risk that they will come impatient and go around at the exactly wrong moment and be struck by a train, and it would just be another, you know, disaster for the railroad. Yeah, so it is something that you'd want to get resolved very quickly. And again, it puts scrutiny on the management of projects and maintenance.
Martin Cassidy reports on transportation issues for The Advocate in Stamford. Thanks so much, Martin. I appreciate it.
All right, thanks.
We'd like to follow up on something else we've discussed in the past. Nurses and technicians at Lawrence and Memorial Hospital have reached an agreement after ongoing labor disputes. Joining us now by phone is Harriet Jones, WNPR's business editor and reporter. Hey, Harriet, how are you?
Morning, John.
So what happened at this week's press conference? What do we know about L&M?
So there seemed to be a great outbreak of peace and harmony in New London this week. After a couple of months of really very bitter dispute, the last time I had covered this, there had been, you know, very extravagant language, dramatic gestures, especially from the union, over this dispute that affects 800 nurses and technicians. The two sides said late last week they had reached agreement. Then on Monday, they had an all-day vote of the membership through a big snowstorm. And on Monday night, both sides came together for a joint press conference. The CEO of the hospital, Bruce Cummings, shared the podium with the chief union negotiator and the other union leaders. There was backslapping, there was handshaking, Bruce Cummings, the CEO, characterized what has happened this way.
As ratified, this agreement brings an end to one of the most challenging times in the 100-plus year history of Lawrence and Memorial.
So the end to a pretty bruising dispute.
The end of a bruising dispute. Let's listen to the main negotiator for the union here, Greg Kotecki.
Because we think that at any point, people will start looking at it as a win-loss, who won a loss. And we don't think that that's going to be advantageous for moving this relationship forward. I will say that, I think you can figure out that the union's interests were met by virtue of the vote.
Okay, so this isn't really about wins and losses here. Now, hopefully there's some backslapping in an agreement. Just so the people understand who aren't in that area, Harriet, why is this such a big deal? Why was this labor dispute such a big deal for L&M and for the people of that region?
Well, here's what's interesting about what Greg Kotecki was saying in that quote. He was describing the fact that both sides, by mutual agreement, have decided to keep the terms of the settlement a secret, which is highly unusual. Usually when, a management union dispute is resolved, we get the headline, we get this is how much the wages are going to be increased, this is the language on job security. None of that came out. We just got told that by both sides that all outstanding issues had been agreed and settled, but they weren't going to tell us what it was. And Greg Kotecki is really saying there that the reason for that is they don't want this to spill over into other negotiations which are coming up with other groups of workers at the hospital. But I think, reading the tea leaves on what he's saying there, it seems a lot like the union got most of what it wanted, but it agreed not to say that, just to save the management's face.
Harriet Jones covers business for WNPR. Thanks for the update, Harriet. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Now, we just have a couple minutes left here, and we were supposed to be previewing the State of the State Address, which is now happening tomorrow at noon as opposed to today at noon. I'll ask you first, Colin, what do you sort of see coming out of this legislative session? Do you have any things that you personally wish that the legislators would take up?
Well, one of the things I will be watching, just to sort of piggyback on what Tom Condon was talking about, is how they do handle not only this freedom of information issue right now, the report of the task force, but how open government and freedom of information issues get processed in general this session. I don't understand, maybe Paz does or Christine or somebody, what's going on at the legislature right now. There were bills last session that were much worse than what was done vis-a-vis the homicide records. There was one that would have, and it made it out of committee, that would have changed the definition of a public meeting to make it a lot easier to meet in private. I'm not quite sure I understand the modern antipathy towards open government and freedom of information. But that's one of the things personally I'll be watching. I don't know how it plays with the public either. I'm not sure the public cares about this quite as much as we journalists and a small group of other people do.
And that may very well be true, Paz.
The irony here is that if the public's right to know is preserved, it's going to be because these bills will be killed secretly.
Yes.
But the general antipathy to freedom of information today, it's because of the web, that this stuff is so easy for anybody to publish, and that's what scares people. And it's a scary thing for journalists, and it should be a scary thing for the public. How much stuff may go behind a wall of secrecy?
So outside of that, Paz, we just have about 30 seconds or so. What do you expect this legislative session to really be about? Obviously, it's about an election year. We get that, but what else?
They're going to look for as many high-profile, low-cost things as possible. Legislative leaders, the Democratic leaders the other day talked about a series of consumer protections geared to protecting the elderly. Trying to protect people against these energy retailers who will come in with these variable rates, and then the rates get jacked up. That'll be a hugely popular thing. People love to run on that. As they were explaining it during the press release, you could visualize the mailer that will arrive in people's houses next September and October.
Mark Pazniokas is Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. Thanks for coming in, Paz. Always good to see you.
My pleasure.
Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. He's going to be talking about the Beatles coming up this afternoon at 1 o'clock. Thanks, Colin.
Thanks, Mr. Dankowski.
Our program is produced by our hero this morning, Tucker Ives, and Lydia Brown. The executive producer is Katie Talarski. I'm John Dankowski. This is Where We Live.